Sin acknowledges and pays respect to the traditional owners of the land on which the Sin office and studios stand, the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nations. Sin also acknowledges and pays respect to the traditional owners of the lands our content reaches, as well as the radio stations we broadcast from across the country.
Welcome back to Film 101, the show that looks at everything film from the biggest new releases to awards hype, right through to our recommendations for films. Now, I am your host, Arnie, and on today's show, I have Darcy, Tom, and myself, obviously, and we'll be looking at two recent features in The King and Knives Out, and we will also be capping the show off with a segment we introduced a couple of weeks ago, the week that was in cinema. So without a second to spare, we're going to head into David Mitrod's not-so-faithful period piece, The King, now available on Netflix from what I understand. It stars Timothée Chalamet as King Henry V, Joel Edgerton as Falstaff, Ben Mendelsohn as King Henry Ivy.
The fourth.
Sean Harris as William, Robert Pattinson as the Dauphin, Lily Rose Depp as Catherine, and Dean Charles Chapman as Thomas. Now the plot, according to Netflix, is Wayward Prince Hal must turn from Karasua to Warrior King as he faces hostilities from inside and outside the castle walls in the battle for England. What were your guys' impressions of The King?
I was actually rather impressed by it. I know that it's been getting pretty ordinary reviews, but no, I found it quite fascinating.
That is quite fascinating, Tom. Because
you didn't like it.
No, I didn't like it.
Okay, so let me just... this is what happened last week with our Marriage Story. So let me try and explain why. Because I thought it was a really interesting story. It was a really interesting way of reinterpreting Shakespeare's original text. The King, of course, is based on Shakespeare's play Henry V. I thought that...
It was based on four different plays. Yeah, it's like Richard II, Henry IV. Mm. Yeah.
Yeah, but Henry V, the Battle of Agincourt, that forms like the main conflict here in this film. But yeah, I enjoyed the music. I thought that the set decoration and the costumes were all brilliant. I particularly loved how they characterized all of these protagonists. So yeah, I enjoy it.
What did The King offer you that films within this genre, like about these period pieces, haven't?
Knights on horseback, sword fighting, medieval stuff. Like the way it's showcased, I guess you could say, medieval Europe for me was quite fascinating.
But I've seen that so many more. But look at those classic Macbeth films. It's a similar sort of thing. Obviously, this deals with King Henry more so. But looking at that, I can get the exact same sort of impression from watching something like that as I can from watching this. And I was saying as well, what I didn't like here was the fact that it detracted so much from the youth side of things. Like it set itself up in the first 15 or 20 minutes as an interesting kind of telling of, what Timothy Chalamet's how he's, the kind of portrait it's going to paint of him. And then it kind of just deviates from that and goes into a fully fledged, blockbuster, but it's not a blockbuster.
I didn't see that at all, but I will let Darcy talk in a moment, I swear. But I saw it as a boy's transition into manhood and how violence and war was sort of robbing him of his youth and his innocence.
That's where I think it didn't work. I think that's what the intention was.
Is this just payback for last week?
No, I'll put it this way. I really liked the last 45 minutes of this movie. I thought that was really excellent. I think they stole a lot of stuff from the Battle of the Bastards episode of Game of Thrones. But besides that, it was really effective storytelling. I just think the first hour and a half is just way too much of a slog in terms of pacing, in terms of where I'm supposed to focus my attention.
I will concede that. It is a very slowly paced movie, and it does take a long time to build up to that climax, which is the Battle of Agincourt.
But I feel like the slog that I had for the first 90 minutes, which is an entire film worth of content, the emotional resonance just wasn't available for most of the thing. Because I feel like it is trying to be a really personal, intimate story about this guy who's early 20s, probably.
So late
then
teens, early
16.
20s,
yeah. And he's forced into this extraordinary circumstance, which is a universal story. And they're not really addressing that. I feel like they're kind of trying to tell the story of an entire country through one person, but they're not talking about the one person.
I don't know. I just think they could have benefited more if they had focused more on that, on him as a character,
scale
on him as
a, of this movie.
Yeah, keep it more intimate within him and his kind of interactions with like Falstaff and his estrangement from his father, and not just, you know, oh, we're gonna knock, you know, his father Ben Mendelsohn out of the picture, and then. It's not a spoiler, by the way. And then we're just going to thrust him.
It's not a spoiler because it happens in the original. Yeah,
you can't
text.
Get to Henry V without Henry IV.
That's like, right. Yeah. and kind of we're just going to end up thrusting this young boy into power and how he kind of manages power. And it's just I've seen these power dynamics and how they kind of lead to greed and kind of a loss of clarity. I've seen that so many times.
This is like
before.
The OG story. I think that's kind of like. The issue is that this is like the first telling of this sort of story.
Yeah, if anything, those other films and stories are taking inspiration from Henry V.
Yeah, I just don't think it does enough to make it interesting, I think, for like the majority of the film. Like for me personally.
Well, one of the most intriguing things is they've kept the plot, essentially, but they've taken away what makes Shakespeare so special, and that's like the wordplay, the poetry.
Yeah. Oh, no, the dialogue, I had such an issue with this movie.
Because it's just, but, like, in part, that's because Timothée Chalamet is just, he's not convincing enough for me to deliver those lines.
I just don't think they put him in a situation to be convincing. I feel like he's, like, talking in this grand gesture, but he's also doing it in, like, that loud whispering voice that I hate in most, like, epic movies, of when he's like a grizzled husky voice, but then it's coming from someone that doesn't have that sort of voice.
Hey, we fight for our country.
And that's everyone's voice, and it's just really strange.
No one could have heard. There's no chance anyone in his army could have heard him in that last battle scene. Like people standing at the back of that army. There's no way they could have heard him yelling. I don't care if he's king, whatever. Mm. There's no way people could have heard him. And like I thought, this film could have benefited more from a larger focus on the kind of Robert Pattinson aspect, like that kind of satirical humor. I've mentioned here.
He was wild.
He was having fun.
He was, but the traces kind of of Terry Gilliam's humor. Like that, I feel like that could have benefited more. Obviously, David Michonne and Joel Edgerton were going for something more serious because they collabed on this screenplay. Mm. But if they had kept it, I think more in that kind of the way that they went about Robert Pattinson's character, he's almost like a satirical take
like,
on the Delphine.
Yeah, but even like that's a more Shakespearean kind of character. Mm. I think someone with a lot of charm, with like a lot of humor, like behind
a
menace.
Personality.
Yeah, like a personality behind like a menacing figure, because he's doing both things.
I saw elements of humor in Joel Edgerton's character though.
Yeah, on he's the most like fleshed out character, which is kind of a concerning thing when he writes the story.
Well, yeah, Joel Edgerton's obviously pushing himself in here. So,
yeah.
I mean, honestly, though, he is a great actor, and I don't think he gets near enough recognition.
Yeah,
yeah. And for that matter, Sean Harris.
The cast of this is actually excellent. Like Thomasin McKenzie's in one scene, and he's like one of my favorite Kiwi actresses, and she's like the Hal's sister, who's the Queen of Denmark, and she just does so much in one scene. They're like, can we just follow her for a little bit?
She was in Jojo Rabbit as well, from what I
saw. She was, yeah.
And Leave No Trace from last year.
Yeah, so she's a rising star. Yeah. The film is also received, in terms of its critical score, so it's actually holding up really well. 72% on Rotten Tomatoes, 7.3 on IMDb, and 61% on Metacritic.
Which is actually pretty
fair.
Good.
That is good.
I would say I would put it around that.
What, a 7 or a 60?
Like between 6 and 7. I think the ending at like really capstones the whole thing. And like, if you can stick a landing, I'm going to appreciate that.
I think it sits at a 5 for me, if we're going out of 10.
And you've been throwing mud at it, and you're giving it a 5, really?
That's half, so I gave it a similar score.
I think a half is pretty generous, given what you said about the movie.
Well, because there's commendable aspects. I mean, how can you not appreciate the kind of the magnitude of this film, how much work has actually gone into it? Because we were talking as well, the production crew that they've got on this.
They have like, so the main three I was stood out for was Nicholas Britell, who's the score, does all the music for it. He's one of the best working film composers at the moment.
He did the score for Moonlight.
For Moonlight,
yeah.
If Beale Street Can Talk, Succession, Vice, all those movies.
Is Adam Arkapor as well?
He's an Australian cinematographer. And Fiona Crombie, who just got an Oscar nomination for The Favourite, so kind of working. And that was the sort of thing I found lacking, was kind of the costuming was like the really bland medieval one, where
in fairness, there is a lot of color washing in the cinematography. Like it's quite dark and brown.
It's not an appealing setting. For
it's sort of like we're going for realism, but then the audience is kind of like, I don't really want all of this realism because it's becoming kind of boring and sad.
But that's why I would have wanted something more, you know, like Monty Python-esque, like that sort of thing. Like
Holy Grail style.
Yeah, that's right. Take
just like, yeah, it just needs to be lighter on its feet.
Yeah, don't take the story too seriously, and maybe you can kind of get more, I guess, more out of these performances and more out of these characters, at least for me. Like that's,
yeah, and I feel like that may have been an issue more with editing almost, because a lot of the shots were like very long, like 7 to 8 second cuts that I feel like could have been sped up to like quicken this movie. And like a lot of the shots, you just don't know why they're in there.
Yeah.
Sort of stuff like that.
Questionable decisions. And the film's been nominated as well at the ACT Awards. It's received 13 nominations, which is one of the highest as well this year.
Is that a record?
No, it's not.
Didn't Fury Road get?
Oh,
like,
I beg your pardon.
Odd,
yeah, I sorry. Think? It was nominated in just about every category
for films. Yeah, for shows, I think Lambs of God has broken the record for the amount of nominations. But ACT Awards here for Best Lead Actor, they've got obviously for Chalamet, Best Direction, David Mitchell, Best Cinematography, Adam Arkapoor, Best Film for Brad Pitt, Dede Gardiner, Jeremy Kleiner, Liz Watts, David Mitchell, and Joel Edgerton. Best Supporting Actor for Joel Edgerton, Best Supporting Actor for Ben Mendelsohn, Best Screenplay for David Mitchell and Joel Edgerton, Best Editing, Best Sound, Best Production Design, Best Costume Design, Best Hair and Makeup, and Best Casting. In all fairness, I understand the nominations. There's not really much that can go up against it, like in terms of, like, when you look at production design, costume design, hair and makeup, and that.
I think my critiques of the movie are just because all of the talent is there and all the potential is for, like, an absolute classic movie is here. And that's kind of where my, like, dislike of sections of it are, because there are parts that I like so much.
Yeah. Well, the nominations aspect of it, like, I just don't see another Australian film apart from The Nightingale having any sort of
chance.
With
the sort of backing. Yeah.
Yeah, when you look at, you know, Netflix obviously backing it. And the film wasn't actually supposed to be nominated, but ACTA bent the rules in order to allow it and it gave it that extra time to kind of have its theatrical
run. I mean, technically it is an Australian production, so...
Well, yeah, it was shot in, like, Hungary and Britain, I believe, as well. So it was, all over the place. And in terms of some fun facts as well, Timothy Chalamet stated that his funniest memory from filming was to see Robert Pattinson smoking a jewel on set in full armor and makeup.
Okay.
Interesting there.
That's a good sight.
The scene where the dolphin wants to fight Hal but is unable to stop slipping in the mud in his fancy armor was played by Robert Pattinson himself. Despite appearing in full body armor, Pattinson insisted on doing the stunt. A stuntman also did the scene, but Pattinson's turned out to be the better take.
Yeah. That's great. That was a great scene.
Yeah, it was.
All characters also exist in real life except John Falstaff. William Shakespeare based Falstaff in his plays Henry IV, Parts 1 and 2, loosely on the historical Sir John Oldcastle, a companion of Prince Henry, but had to rename him because of Oldcastle's powerful family. A bit of history there. Ironically, in the film, Chalamet was representing England, but he's actually French-American, whereas Pattinson, who represents France, is English in real life. So would have been an interesting to see them on opposite ends of the spectrum. The Dolphins, or Robert Pattinson's heavily French-accented English, was intentional to better insult and disrespect Chalamet's King Henry. Director-writer Michaud cast Pattinson very early in the writing process because he needed the Dolphin to, quote-unquote, pop out, stating, quote-unquote, "I love how bold Robert Pattinson is. I wanted him to go nuts with it. His whole purpose is to be a jerk and to just torment Hal." Which makes sense. Lily Rose Depp and Timothy Chalamet also started dating in September 2018 after they filmed scenes together in June, July of 2018. Principal photography took place again in England and Hungary from June to August 2018. Timothy Chalamet and the cast spent several weeks training horse riding and sword fighting. And this is also David Michaud's second collaboration with Netflix after...
I was going to say
The Woeful War Machine of 2017.
It was Netflix's first, like, big splash movie.
Yeah, and for some reason they brought Michaud back for a second Netflix film. I was saying to Darcy...
I assume a lot of people saw War Machine.
Yeah, and that was mainly because of Brad Pitt.
And Brad Pitt's here, obviously.
As a producer.
Producer as well. You're listening to the Film 101 podcast on Sin. We are going to head into our second segment of the day, looking at Knives Out, Rian Johnson's recent feature. And me and Tom saw this last night, and I think it's safe to say we had a fairly enjoyable time. I think most of the audience had a fairly enjoyable time.
Yeah, it's good that we're agreeing on the movie this episode.
Tom, it's a rarity that we don't agree, though.
Well, that's true. Actually, most of the time we just find ourselves agreeing with each other.
Yeah, and that doesn't make for good radio, does it, Tom?
No, unfortunately not.
What were your impressions of this film? I know that we both had... I think I can speak for you as well, that we both did have a fun time.
Yeah.
And I think Rian Johnson is, like, great at making a film that's just fun and like doing content that's really fun that you can enjoy. Not many people agree with that with following The Last Jedi, but I think people
No,
I love The Last Jedi. I'm just saying there's that minority, but the people that do kind of follow his work can appreciate. His sense of humor and his kind of wit and his writing and his directing style. Yeah. And I think that we both had that sort of impression after this as well.
Absolutely. There was a lot of energy in this movie, and I approached Knives Out as somebody who is all too familiar with the murder mystery genre. My family just consumes it like reality TV. I mean, I think I've watched every episode of New Tricks, Midsummer Murders, A Touch of Frost.
Are you big on like the 70s Agatha Christie movies?
Here's the thing, because we've got all three versions of Murder of the Orient Express at home. So we've got the original version with Albert Finney, original, so to speak. We've got Kenneth Branagh's version, and we've got the TV version with David Suchet. So that gives you a sense of how much my family loves murder mysteries. And honestly, I'm sick of them. Like, honestly, I've seen so many of them, I find myself just guessing the murderer within the first 5 minutes.
Well, there's a film called Murder Mystery that we talked about this year, so there you go. It's right in its title.
It's exactly right. But no, I really enjoyed myself with Knives Out, and it wasn't so much the detective part of the story that I enjoyed, but everything else that came with it. I mean, the characters, the shenanigans, the humour, you know, it was just really well done.
I think that's always the best part of murder mystery genres, is that you can get a massive, like, A-list ensemble and you can make them all insane characters that can just pair off like, have really interesting interactions, and then the plot just kind of slowly churns on its own.
Well, that's what I wanted to mention, actually, because the plot is really interesting. It starts as your typical murder mystery fare, and then half an hour in, it reveals how our victim died. And more or less who killed him. And then it becomes an entirely different movie. It sort of morphs from being a traditional Agatha Christie mystery to something like Columbo. And then I don't know if you're familiar with Columbo, Arnie.
No.
So Columbo was a huge TV detective, huge in the sense that he was popular and everywhere, who would basically whittle down the chief suspect until they confessed. So the TV audience would see the murder as it happened, and then from there it would just be Columbo, you know, using his deductive powers to try and work out how this person committed this crime. So it's sort of like a reverse of Agatha Christie's formula. Rather than working it down to see who done it, we already knew who did it, and then, so that's one of the things that is interesting about Knives Out. So it goes from being a whodunit to they did it, and then it morphs into another movie entirely. It's like pulls the rug out from under you twice.
I agree that was interesting. Because I was mentioning to Darcy as well, you know, it doesn't just center on the house. It goes out of the house, and the conventional setting for a lot of these films is, you know, in one space.
Yeah.
Like, obviously, Murder on the Orient Express, you've mentioned, it's specifically on the train. But I did find when it kind of went out of the house that's when you can kind of sense that Rian Johnson is stepping away from the traditional approaches to the subgenre. But I kind of lost... There was aspects of it there that I would have preferred, like, it centered on... If it was just, like, around the house, it was centered... like on the house specifically, because once they do that reveal, like I kind of, you lose a bit of that traction, like that kind of, how do I put it? The kind of,
like the active watching kind of.
No, that's a bit fair actually, because when the murder is revealed as such, it sort of like feels like an anticlimax. I mean, and you still got another, an hour, 90 minutes of the film left to see.
So it's like in Law and Order when they catch the killer and like 20 minutes in, you're like, but it's a 45-minute episode. Like, obviously this isn't what's happening.
Yeah, that's a fair point.
That's also like in and of itself, like an enjoyable aspect of the film, because then you're like, what's coming after this part? Where's he going to take it now?
Yeah, with that said, I'd be interested to see a different cut of this film where they just followed that conventional formula and seeing whether it had the same effect on me.
If they just centered around the house?
Or... I'm saying that if it, rather than, you know, being three different detective stories, it just was the one detective story in the one style.
Because there's a lot of... But like, what's so great here is this. There's a lot of, like, moments where you think you know... And I think that's that's the case with a lot of these murder mystery films. But like you kind of think you know the answer, or you think you've kind of picked up on something, and then it's kind of taken away from you in that instance. And then Rian Johnson, but like when he was heading towards that closing sequence. I'm not going to say what happened. How do I say this without saying what happened?
Just say it, Arnie.
No, I don't want to ruin this for Darcy.
kind soul.
that last kind of closing sequence wasn't kind of as strong for me as the rest of the film was. Okay. The kind of build up and because it almost felt rushed in some sense. Like, let's kind of get all this information in one.
And a lot of murder mysteries, particularly Agatha Christie's stories, are like that. They'll give you all this information, and then within the last 4 minutes of the show, it's like the main protagonist says, "Hold on, I've had a light bulb moment. This is what actually happened."
Yeah, there's always like the large like detective monologue at the end of those sort of movies and books and everything.
Like, it's especially the case with a show like Death in Paradise. It's like, how did he come to that conclusion so quickly?
Like, obviously,
yeah.
But at the same, like, you can't hate these characters. I don't think they
are all great characters. I mean, Daniel Craig especially as Benoit Blanc. I mean, I want to see more movies with Benoit Blanc.
Yeah, well, we were saying as well, me and you, that, you know, much like with Wesley Snipes, who we spoke about, I think it was last week, a couple of weeks ago, he was born for these sort of roles.
Yes,
like,
he's so close to being free from James Bond.
He's just got one more movie and then that's it.
But this is kind of like this is kind of the bridge between James Bond and everything that he's probably going to do afterwards. Mm-hmm. Like, it's kind of like that slow that shift or change. But the rest of the cast is fantastic as well. You know, you've got Chris Evans as Ransom Drysdale. Even though he doesn't play, initially, he's not in the film for like the first fair bit.
Yeah, this is really interesting. So he gets second billing behind Craig, and yet he turns out to be one of the lesser characters in the movie.
And Ana de Armas wasn't also, like, she wasn't pitched as, from looking at the marketing material and the poster and that, she's not the center, like, based on that. But then when you watch the film, she's the prank. That was almost the mystery in and of itself. Yeah. Like, who was going to be the main kind of driving force of this film? You've got Daniel Craig's obviously there. He's always constantly supporting, and he's giving that support to her character. But yeah, like, there was never any clear sort of impression of who was going to be in kind of the driving
And it's
seat.
A good mixture of like old seasoned actors and like the young emerging ones, like Lakeith Stanfield and Ana de Armas. As being like the youth,
and then you got Don Johnson from Miami Vice. I mean, what's he been doing recently?
He's just in Watchmen.
Beg your pardon. So, yeah. Oops, he was too.
And then you've got Jamie Lee Curtis as part of that kind of maturing cast as Linda Drysdale. You've got Michael Shannon, more or less, still middle age, as Walt Thrombey. And then you've got Toni Collette in there as well as Joni Thrombey. Oh, so she kind of fits in with the Michael Shannon.
Yeah.
And then you've got Christopher Plummer, who's
it's
obviously
like 10 leads. Like,
it's really right.
Well, yeah, these people, like, look at each in different periods of like the last 50 years, they would have been lead, like big name leads.
Absolutely.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And here they've obviously played, like, a lot of them are playing side characters, but, and the budget for the film is only 40 million. Yeah. We say only 40 million because looking at these cast, like, some of these people, Daniel Craig can probably get 20 million off a film.
Yeah.
I reckon.
And the set dressing is just like incredible from the look of things.
It is.
And it's ridiculous how much it kind of borders between a period piece and a modern telling. Like, it jumps between the two because, like, the house is almost this it's almost stuck in
a Victorian era home.
Yeah. And then you just see, like, Christopher Plummer, like, pull out a laptop out of nowhere, and it's like, oh, okay. It's like, okay, yeah, I'm not gonna forget that this is set in like the modern time. In terms of the critical scores, it's received 96% on Rotten Tomatoes, 7.6 on IMDb, and 85% on Metacritic. People are loving it, and I think people are just having a fun time with the film.
And that's what's been sorely missing from the murder mystery genre. It's that it hasn't been able to make us laugh, essentially, because all of these stories are just profoundly ridiculous, and everybody takes them so seriously.
Well, because look at murder mystery. Murder mystery was leaning so much more on the comedic side.
Yeah.
And it kind of missed the mark. And then the recent Murder on the Orient Express was leaning so much more on the serious side and it missed the mark. Whereas this just, like, finds a nice balance between the two.
Mm.
And obviously Rian Johnson as well. Like, the guy's known for...
Hang on, is it Rian or Ryan?
I think it's Rian. He put an I in his name. I'll trust him.
I've heard it pronounced differently. I've heard people pronounce
it both
Ryan
ways,
as well.
So,
He probably doesn't care anyway. but yeah, like, he finds, like... people who are, like, obviously familiar with his work, he's so, like, he's got real attention to detail. And I think with him, like, for me, upon, like, his films get better upon rewatch, at least for me. Like, that's what I found with The Last Jedi, with Looper.
Oh, this is definitely going to be one of those movies. You watch it again and everything will make sense.
Well, I told you after the screening, I'm like, I think I need to see this again. And but even more so now, because murder mysteries generally tend to be more convoluted than your general film. But, like, after this, cause it's a Rian Johnson murder mystery, so now it's even more convoluted.
It's like his initial interests are, like, merging with the default kind of murder mystery theology.
And it becomes even more complex and, like, takes a life of its own. And people have said it's, like, one of the best whodunits in decades. Like, I've heard people say decades. Yeah. In terms of its nominations, it won the Audience Award for Best Feature at the Philadelphia Film Festival, and was nominated for Audience Award for Rian Johnson at the Fantastic Fest. So it hasn't received too many noms. Do you guys think that it will have much more, anything else coming into, you know,
given that it's trying to be a crowd-pleasing blockbuster, I don't think it's going to get a lot of traction. And also, it's being released by Lionsgate in the US, and they don't have the money that Disney or Warner Brothers or so on and so forth have. But it does stand a slim chance, I think, maybe in the smaller categories, like the comedy section of the Golden Globes. I think it'll be pretty strong there. But other than that, yeah, I don't see a lot of Oscar hype for this one. Yeah.
I think that is probably more hopeful that it makes a good amount of money, because I feel like this sort of genre doesn't really get its heyday in, like, actual box office.
No, definitely
especially
not.
For, like, a non-IP sort of thing in 2019.
Yeah, if we remember back to Kenneth Branagh's Murder on the Orient Express 2 years ago, Fox just put that out in October, November, thinking, oh, you know, maybe this will make some money, and it ended up being a huge hit. It took them by surprise.
And I wanted to bring in this little, I wrote a little kind of joke. Tom will get it. Darcy, you'll get it. You'll get it soon. I put, like, because of how like, Rian Johnson knows how to kind of want you, like, coming back with seconds, I put, like, it's kind of the same case with this film above his prior to, and I said, like, it's a Rian Johnson film within a Rian Johnson film, or a donut with a hole that has another donut with a hole in it.
Yep.
So, yeah.
That's pretty much it.
That's it. It'll make more sense soon, everyone. Rian Johnson has also described Daniel Craig's character as an American Poirot, I believe? Poirot.
So, Hercule Poirot is the Belgian detective created by Agatha Christie, and obviously his name, Benoit Blanc, it's a French name,
But he speaks, like, is his accent French?
No.
He's American.
It was described as a Kentucky foghorn, leghorn type thing.
Very close to his Logan Lucky accent.
Although not as convincing as his Logan Lucky voice, I found, because he sort of, like, flips in and out of it every now and then. He can just hear traces of British Daniel Craig. I kind of wish that he had used his natural speaking voice, because I think that would have been funnier.
This is also Rian Johnson's first time producing one of his movies as well, which is interesting. Obviously, I think he would have had to, because, based on the funding for this and to get more kind of traction for it. Whereas when you're doing The Last Jedi, people do that for you. You don't have to.
Yeah, and the scale of the stuff he was making before Last Jedi. So it was like a massive jump after that.
Yeah, and he would have. The fact that he wasn't doing producing for his work prior to Last Jedi is also quite surprising for me, because he wasn't a household name at the time. It was obviously.
I think he became a producer of Breaking Bad by the end. I think that's the closest he got.
Yeah, they say here for movies, so I'm not sure how it would work for the shows. It's also the first Rian Johnson feature to not feature any involvement from Joseph Gordon-Levitt.
Fun collab.
Yeah, because he's not doing anything these days. When was the last time you saw him acting in anything?
Do you know what he's doing? And I've stopped following him on Twitter for this. I've actually blocked him on Twitter, even though he's never going to follow
him. He does too much.
All he does on Twitter is he posts these things, like these links, and he's like, take your best picture of this and upload it here. And then people, like, comment, and they're like, oh, blah, blah, blah. And he's like, that's great, but upload it here. And he's like, I'm like, what's he doing? Because, you know, a lot of these people are doing, like, they're selling their phone numbers, or they're putting in their phone, like, fake assistant phone numbers on, like, Twitter and that, and they're getting people to, like, call, and it's just, like, another way of getting your information.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, so I'm kind of getting the impression that he's, like, I don't know if his Twitter account's actually him anymore, but, like, I'm not taking any part in these shenanigans. So I just blocked him, even though he's never going to know who I am. You're listening to the Film 101 podcast on Sin. We're going to head into our final segment of the day, basically recapping the week that was in cinema, looking at all the kind of significant stories and, I guess, what we found significant or most interesting about
the week that was.
That's right. I can't put it any other way. So to start us off, Disney Plus has actually launched in Australia, guys. Mm-hmm. I know, Darcy, you've kind of had some interaction with it. I'm yet to do so. I don't know whether I will. What are your first impressions of Disney Plus?
I mean, it looks pretty much exactly the same as Netflix, which, like, compared to all the other non-Netflix streaming things, I guess it's a
in terms
welcome
of, like, layout.
Thing. Yeah, like the way it's laid out. They separate all of, like, the different divisions of Netflix of Disney, which makes sense. So, like,
so the Star Wars, Marvel, Nat Geo,
yeah,
that kind
Pixar,
of thing. Yeah,
and like, I think like a vague kids section.
Mm.
Yeah.
Well, what's this going to mean? I've put here a question for the streaming wars, because we're seeing a lot of kind of dominance now, and you know, Stan has lost its Disney content to Disney.
Mm.
So so I don't know what's going to happen to their subscription service, whether they're still worth.
They'll be fine. They're still a route, because they have a lot of like the Hulu content, and Disney's said that they're going to keep Hulu separated from Disney Plus.
Yeah, also it's worth remembering Stan has a lot of original content in as well.
Yeah.
So it's not like they're going to fold just because Disney's removed all their
and
content.
And it's predominantly our second biggest streaming platform.
Mm.
Yeah, you mentioned Disney is going to kind of keep Hulu on its own, yet they're offering kind of packages where you can get Disney, you can get Hulu, and I believe ESPN
and
is
ESPN
the other
Plus.
One.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So they're still offering, like, it's become, like, and we've mentioned this, it's become like a cable all over again.
Yeah, pretty much has.
Yeah, yeah. So I think it's less nowadays, like, it's becoming more, less of, like, the streaming wars and more, like, a hierarchy. Because I think Disney's definitely going to cement itself as, like, 1A to Disney, to Netflix.
But it's also worth noting that what Disney Plus is offering is a lot less confusing than what a certain other cable TV provider is offering. Because you know, the package is there. It's just if you want a little bit of this and a little bit of that, they don't offer everything you want altogether. You need to buy these smaller, separate packages in order to get all the channels
this
you
is,
want.
This is still a similar sort of thing, though, because a lot of people want to have, you know, two or three, and they end up signing themselves up for, you know, both Netflix and
yes, but you know
Amazon
you know what you're signing up for. If you sign up for ESPN Plus, you know you're going to get sport and not some of these other weird, wacky channels that provide content you're never going to watch.
It's just, but that's the same thing. It's just a matter of, well, are you going to end up watching everything that's on there? I know for me, and I'm still selective of what I watch on Netflix. I don't know whether the amount I'm paying is kind of worth it, because I'm not watching half, like 80% of the things on there.
Mm.
So I don't know whether that's kind of viable, and you're seeing now as well, Disney's kind of, they've come up with like an entry sort of price. It's a low price. I think Amazon's the only one that's cheaper right now. Obviously, they're gonna bump their price up as time goes. But
inflation and what have you, yeah.
Well, that and the fact that more people are kind of going to lean on them for kind of content, because they're still in release. They've got so much more content that's coming in as well.
Because they actually are a content company. I think that's the major difference between Disney and Netflix and the Apple Plus and Amazon.
It's like they've got the reverse approach in Nintendo, because you know how they jack their prices up really high when they launch stuff and then it gets lower as time goes on? It's sort of like the opposite way for streaming services, how they start low and then they just build up and up and up.
Yeah, because it's easier to gain an audience and then try to keep them than make something expensive and then hope they stay.
No, that's fair.
Because they'd rather that, and then, you know, you're probably going to be less inclined to kind of let that service go as well, especially if you're more faithful with it.
Yeah.
Godzilla vs. Kong has reportedly been delayed from March 2020 to November 2020. So almost an 8-month kind of pushback.
I think the November period is probably going to suit the film a lot better than March will, because March, that's where blockbusters go to die. Because especially in like a place like Australia, it's like in the middle of the first semester of university. It's sort of like in the middle of school term. And in the US, it's during the exam period. It's before the summer blockbuster season hits. So it's like a really bad time to be releasing a movie.
And November's definitely becoming like a proper box office.
Like, yeah, when we were mentioning last week with Fox, they had Ford v Ferrari. The year before that, they had Bohemian Rhapsody. And the year before that was Murder on the Orient Express. Mm. They've used November as their real mega release period.
Yeah. And even Joker this year is like October and November. It's kind of combined into two.
Mm.
Yeah, well, but we've mentioned those ones because they're almost, you know, original films in some sense, whether it's hiring that. But look at this, like this month, what's happened with some films. Terminator Dark Fate's bombed.
Yeah.
Charlie's Angels has bombed.
That's fair.
What's the other one?
But their issues aren't the month that it came out. Theirs is
Doctor Sleep has bombed.
A reboot of something that people weren't asking for. That's a bigger issue.
Are you really going to pass up the opportunity to see King Kong take on Godzilla? I mean, that's the question we're asking here. No, no, you're not.
I'm not going to pay to watch that in cinema.
Yes, you are.
Where else? You're not going to watch it anywhere else.
Well, we will. But yeah, no, I'm not going to pay to see. I didn't watch the last one in a cinema.
But
either.
It's King Kong going up against Godzilla. But the two of the biggest monsters ever put the screen.
King Kong from 2005.
Well, no, I was going to say
King Kong from
this is the Kong from Kong Skull Island. So it's
discount Kong.
I do forget that.
I beg your pardon.
It's the Samuel non-Peter Jackson, Jackson one. Yeah, that one. Yeah, with Samuel Jackson. Yeah,
yeah. Well, but in fairness, that design is closer to the original design that we've become familiar with.
From the 30s?
From the 33 movie.
Well, that was actually one of Peter Jackson's favourite films of all time, so that's that led him to make King Kong 2005.
Yeah, but the 2005 one, it's just like a huge gorilla. It doesn't look anything like...
But that's what you want. You want a huge gorilla.
Yeah, but not one with, like, hair growing all over the place.
Yeah, well, I mean, that shows that, you know, that people have come from gorillas.
No, sorry, this discussion has got way off track. I'm sorry.
Frozen 2 has also achieved the biggest worldwide opening for an animated film ever at US $350.2 million over the weekend.
This movie's going to be wild. Like, it's actually going to possibly make $2 billion.
Yeah, like, it hasn't even released in most international territories yet, and it's already, like, made this massive impact.
And we were mentioning this prior to the show as well. It's the fact that Frozen was so big at the time. Mm. And
it's grown. I think the audience for it has actually been the last 3 years, came out.
Yeah, that's one of the really interesting things about Frozen. It's because even though it got high critical praise at the time of its release, it was sort of like a slow burner. It wasn't like until December, January that people really got into it.
And it still made up $1.2 billion, I think, in box office.
I also have to mention here, following Dark Fate's lackluster theatrical run, and that's Terminator Dark Fate, Tim Miller opened up about the process of working on the film, saying that he's, quote-unquote, sure we could write a book on why it didn't work, and that, quote-unquote, the things they... being audiences, seem to hate the most about the movie were things I can't control, including the hate towards Terminator Genesis and Salvation, the sour taste they left. Mm. Miller also addressed the creative struggle between him, James Cameron, and Skyline, I believe, David Ellison, saying that, quote-unquote, even though Jim is a producer and David Ellison is a producer, and they technically have final cut and ultimate power, my name is still on it as director. So Miller also didn't direct Deadpool 2, due to creative differences between himself and Ryan Reynolds. Mm. And he's also said that he wouldn't work with Cameron again for the same sort of reason, according to the Hollywood Reporter.
So I wonder what led him to make the film completely. Whereas in Deadpool 2, he dropped out.
Well, Deadpool 2, I think it was sort of like creative differences, whereas Miller wanted this big, you know, Terminator-style blockbuster, and Ryan Reynolds wanted that smaller, more intimate film.
Yeah.
And so that's where the two of them kind of clashed. I also think it's worth mentioning James Cameron himself spoke to Empire magazine, and he made mention of the turbulent production as well. So it's sort of like having final say during editing, having arguments with Miller in post-production. So, there's bad blood on both sides, it would seem.
Yeah, but he still viewed it as, like, Cameron even said, like, he said that he still viewed it as, like, that ended up okay at the end, that he was still happy with the film and the
outcome. That's true,
And Miller mentioned, like, him and Cameron, they still talk, and the Cameron's, you know, contact him about having a quote unquote beer. But yeah, Miller mentioned, you know, I can say no with regards to working with Cameron, but it has nothing to do with whatever trauma I have from the experience. It's more that I just don't want to be in a situation again where I don't have the control to do what I think is right. And I think that's it's an interesting thing because James Cameron obviously holds his you know, franchises close to heart and views them in, I guess he's brought them to us. So it's kind of fair that he's still got these deep-rooted connections to them, but then why doesn't he go out? We know he's making his five Avatar films. Yeah, why doesn't he go out and make another Terminator if he thinks he can do it better than you know, Tim Miller or people that, you know, that these guys have faith in?
That's true. If he really has the confidence in this project, surely he himself would take the reins and say, "I can do this."
Because it's deterred Miller from franchising anymore. He says he doesn't want to do any more franchise films, so he's going to step down to do something more intimate.
Well, this is like the bad part of creating franchise movies. That's why, like, the Star Wars directors have kicked out three of them, basically.
Three? Have they?
Wasn't it?
From
like different Star Wars, like the Solo movie, they kicked out Lord Miller. They kicked out...
Rogue One, I think there were extensive reshoots. Lord and Miller left Solo due to creative differences, and Colin Trevorrow left Episode 9.
Yeah, because his movie bombed the year before. That was upsetting. That's a wild thing.
Hang on, which movie was that?
A movie no one saw.
Oh.
Is that the title?
A Jacob Tremblay movie, I'm pretty sure.
I think. Yeah, he was in it. I heard that they also had trouble with him on the set of Jurassic World, and that was another reason why you know, Lucasfilm were kind of like, you know, not keen on hiring him.
Yeah.
We could do a whole segment on actor-director relationships and how some of them are not feasible.
We really could.
We really could. We just don't have the time for it today. I just lastly wanted to mention a couple of things. Apparently the Oscars, I just read this randomly, have a store that sells Oscars merchandise. It's not news. I thought it was just absurd.
I don't know who that's for.
I don't know either.
Okay, so where's the Oscars store?
It's online, I believe.
It's online, okay.
But it's an Oscar store that sells, like...
Fake Oscars?
No, it sells, like, jumpers and that. Like, it's so random.
I'd want, like, fake trophies. That would be an audience. Yeah, I'm the audience for that. Give me that.
But the trouble is...
Paying shipping prices purely for a fake Oscar.
The trouble is, if you travel down Hollywood Boulevard, there's, like... several dozen stores dedicated to, you know, handing out fake Oscar trophies.
Okay.
So, yeah.
And just before we wrap up, The Lighthouse will be having its Victorian premiere in January next year at Lido Cinemas.
Already have tickets.
Three months too late. I'm sorry.
You took the words right out of my mouth, Tom. And I think with that, we're going to wrap up for today. We've looked at The King. We've looked at Rian Johnson's Knives Out and obviously the week that was in cinema. Next week, I think we can give a little teaser of what's to come, Tom.
Yeah, I reckon we can. So Frozen 2 comes out in Australia this Thursday, and I'm really keen on checking that one out. Judy and Punch is another Australian movie, which came out recently. It's got a lot of nominations at the Actor Awards, and Arnie... Yes.
Well, I'm not going to say it, Tom, because I'm not sure, but yes, I might
be... going to commit to him on radio.
Yeah, he wants me to commit. No, I might be going to the Actor Awards next week, but we'll see what happens in the week leading up. Thanks, guys, for being in the show today. Tom, where can you find us?
You can find us on Facebook. We're at facebook.com/film101syn. You can follow us on Twitter at film101syn. And you can also shoot us an email via film101syn@gmail.com.
Indeed. And we'll see you next week.
Bye-bye.
See ya.